Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Mark Lobel, and at 1300 GMT on Tuesday the 16th of July, these are our main stories. The German Defence Minister Ursula von der Leyen is making her case to convince the European Parliament she should get the top job in the European Commission. More than 130 people have died in South Asia in heavy rainfall and flooding. President Zuma is facing another day of questioning in his corruption trial. Also in this podcast, we hear from Iran, where the economic impact of US sanctions is dragging more and more people into poverty. And
I was with my family at my grandmother's home, staring at a tiny TV, you know, black and white, and just riveted.
On the 50th anniversary of the Apollo 11 moon launch, we'll hear how it inspired a little girl who went on to become an astronaut herself. As we record this podcast, MEPs are gathered in Strasbourg, where they're due to vote on whether German Defence Minister Ursula von der Leyen should become the next EU Commission president. She would replace Jean-Claude Juncker. She's been making her pitch ahead of a secret ballot later on Tuesday.
Honourable members, the European way is also about using all of our potential, our people, our talent, our diversity. It is about creating a fairer and more equal union. This will drive me forward every single day I am in office, as it has throughout my career.
If elected, she would be the first woman to head the EU Commission. Our correspondent Damian Grammaticus told us more about Ursula von der Leyen.
She is a centre-right politician, ally of Angela Merkel. The way the election result fell, that grouping in the middle doesn't have enough votes to get her through. That's a first for the European Parliament, that's not so easy. So what she's done today is appeal to the left side of the spectrum. Climate change, you heard there, that pledge to be climate neutral, Europe climate neutral by 2050. A carbon border tax she's talking about, so on any imports to reflect the amount of carbon pumped out in producing goods in factories abroad, say in China. That's her climate pitch to the Greens. For the socialists, who are very angry that their candidate was passed over by EU leaders, she's reached out to them by pledging things like an unemployment insurance scheme across Europe, a basic income scheme for workers across Europe too, a minimum wage sort of scheme. So those are things she's trying to pitch to the sort of left and centre-left, but it's unclear still whether she can win enough votes there to get her over the line.
Yeah, quite a balancing act to win the actual vote. But if she does win the vote, there'll be other pressing issues that she'll have to face early on. What did you say about those?
Yes. So on the issue of immigration, particularly refugees, she was very clear about that. She's been under pressure to be quite accommodating on that. And that's another area where she reached out to liberal voters in the sort of centre of the parliament, talking about the fact that she believes the EU has to do more to protect human rights, the rights of refugees, that there should be, she said, a duty to save lives of those trying to cross the Mediterranean to reach the EU. That's a bit controversial with some of the more right-wing governments in Europe. So she's appealing there to the liberals, talking about defending the rule of law against that means investigations of countries like Hungary, more likely. And then Brexit, that big sort of issue that is looming at the end of October. This isn't a vote winner in the chamber, but she laid out very clearly her policy there, which would be to be open to granting the UK more time. So a further extension of the negotiation process, she said, if there was a good reason to do so. And that got a lot of cheers from quite a lot of MEPs.
Damian Grammaticus. The former South African president, Jacob Zuma, is facing a second day of questioning at a corruption inquiry. He's rejected allegations that he was personally corrupt and says he's the victim of a conspiracy. Our correspondent Milton Nkosi is following developments.
President Zuma opened up his testimony by telling the judge that last night between 7 and 8 p.m., his personal assistant received a call where an anonymous caller told the PA, saying that tell Zuma that we are going to kill him, his children and the people around him. And the judge said that no one should be receiving any threats of violence purely by coming to testify here. But he was also wondering whether Mr. Zuma can receive any more protection than he already enjoys. Remember, as former head of state, he still gets a lot of protection from by virtue of having been head of state. So that was the bombshell this morning, which we were not expecting. But then they began briefly into the nitty-gritty of the sacking of one of the senior officials in government who was transferred or stroke sacked because he refused to help the family friends of Mr. Zuma, the Guptas.
Wow, Milton. And before today's dramatic disclosure, Mr. Zuma's legal team were arguing that they haven't received all the necessary documents to hand. How is that argument being received?
So essentially what they were arguing, and that's correct, they were arguing that the line of questioning by the evidence leader amounted to cross-examination. They were saying that their witness, Mr. Zuma, should not be cross-examined because he was not prepared for cross-examination. He was only prepared just to give his side of the story. So there we got into a really deeply legal debate between Mr. Zuma's lawyers and the judge about what litigation means and what an inquisitorial questioning means.
Milton and Cozy in Johannesburg. Every year from June to September, deadly flooding caused by heavy rains is likely as monsoon rains fall in South Asia. This year is sadly no exception. More than 180 people have died across the region. In northern India, at least 3 million people have been displaced, and Bangladesh and Nepal are also badly affected. The United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres said the UN stands ready to help the affected governments. I've been speaking to our correspondent in Delhi, Rajini Vajanathan.
We'll start with Nepal, where more than 67 people have been reported dead, but there are also many more who are missing. Now, a lot of the deaths there are as a result of landslides. Also in Bangladesh, there have been bad floods that have hit hard. A number of fatalities there, actually, Mark, have been as a result of lightning strikes. A lot of farmers have been affected by the lightning there, some losing their lives. But also the world's largest refugee camp, Cox's Bazar in Bangladesh, has also been hit by this adverse weather. Where I am in India, in this country, the states of Assam and Bihar have seen millions of people displaced from their homes, homes submerged. Even a national park, Kaziranga National Park, which is home to a famous one-horned rhino, that is almost completely submerged now. And people are bracing themselves for even more bad weather over the coming days.
And how do these compare to previous years?
A lot of people are citing the floods in 2017, where around 800 people lost their lives over the monsoon seasons. Now, we are only in July and the monsoon season is due to go on until September. So, you know, it is, of course, always bad, no matter how many lives are lost, no matter how many homes are displaced, because, you know, there is nothing that people can do. Aid agencies obviously go in, they do what they can to help with food and resources, but nobody likes to leave their home. And that's what millions of people have been forced to do.
And Rajini, the UN Secretary General has been pledging the UN's help for the governments in these flood-hit countries. Have you seen any sign of help yet?
I haven't been out to any of these areas, but we are hearing reports of, you know, relief centres that have been set up. Now, that happens every year. People who are displaced are taken to safety wherever possible, and they're given food. It might just be basic shelter as well. But as is the case with a lot of these things, Mark, the real challenge in places like South Asia is how to find a long-term solution to make sure that people's lives aren't affected in the same way year on year.
Rajini Vajanathan there. Pakistan has fully reopened its airspace to civilian flights, nearly 5 months after it was closed during a dispute with India. From Islamabad, here's Secunda Kamani.
In February, Pakistan and India carried out rival airstrikes targeting each other's territory in the most dangerous escalation in tensions between the countries in two decades. Even after the crisis subsided, when Pakistan released a captured Indian pilot, a significant number of airways across the country remained closed. As a result, many passengers faced longer journey times and airlines faced increased fuel costs with flights rerouted. Although relations between Pakistan and India have improved since February, they remain tense.
A set of rare conjoined twins have been separated after pioneering surgery here in London. The two-year-old sisters, Safa and Marwa Ullah, from Pakistan, were joined at the top of the head and needed three major operations, totaling nearly 50 hours of surgery time. Virtual reality and 3D printing were also used during the operation to make sure everything went to plan. The two lead surgeons, David Dunaway and Nurul Awasir Jalani, spoke to Lawrence Pollard about the challenges they faced. Mr. Jalani begins.
The brains had adopted quite a twisted configuration, and they were twisted around, wrapped around each other's brain. So the whole surgical process was untwisting the two brains gradually returning them to their own cranial cavities and then reconstructing over the top.
The brains almost look like yin and yang, or sort of a left hand and a right hand gripping at the wrist, I suppose, is the way to describe it. But can I ask also, the shape of the skull that they had, David Dunaway, what is this? Did they in effect have like a cylinder, and they were at either end of a cylinder of bone?
Yes, exactly. The skull is of cylinder shape, and they're joined at the top of the head. We're not quite sure whether in the embryonic life they fail to separate, or they twins separate and join together again. Mm. But effectively, what happened is there's just one long, thin cranial cavity, and the problem with that is to create two round heads from it at the same time as separating the brains,
which you astonishingly managed to do, stretching the skin as well. Yes. With kind of saline sacs underneath the skin, so they have skin to cover their heads. One thing that I want to know is how you visualise the operation, because this is fascinating. This uses computing and scans. You basically had pictures of the brain, images of the skull. How did you practice? Because you don't just go in and do it.
Yes, sure. So one of the great advantages that we have nowadays is the incredible imaging we have. So we have CT scans that image bone and soft tissues, and MRI scans, which are really useful for the brain. And actually, the great thing about modern technology is how we can process that information. So we can look at it in 3D pictures, and now at Great Ormond Street, we have an in-house facility for printing, 3D printing.
So you can hold a model of what you're exactly about to operate on.
Very much so. And that's a really important thing to do, because as surgeons, we're very used to handling things in three dimensions. And so we're effectively able to practice and plan our surgery.
What we've achieved so far is we can do these surgeries and separate the two kids and have two kids alive at the end of it. We've done it three times. All six kids have survived and are doing well. The question really for us for the future is, how do we do this better? We want these kids to be independent, functional people. So just two separate kids is not enough. And that's the question for the future.
Surgeons David Dunaway and Noor Ulawasa Jalani speaking there to Lawrence Pollard. Coming up in this podcast, the UN Refugee Agency says new immigration laws in the United States will put vulnerable people at risk. And we hear from residents of a street in North Wales that has been declared the steepest in the world. Since President Trump pulled out of the Iran nuclear deal last year, the US has been reimposing sanctions on the country. They now encompass hundreds of individuals, companies and organisations, affecting oil, Iran's most important export, as well as shipping and many other kinds of commercial activity, including tourism. As our correspondent Martin Patience has been discovering inside Iran this week, the state of its economy is dragging more into poverty. It's worth noting that the BBC team's access while in Iran was controlled, as with all foreign media. They were accompanied by a government representative at all times.
There's some pretty serious judo going on here. Thankfully, there's a padded floor. And all these young boys are from vulnerable families in this neighbourhood. This is one of the poorest districts of Tehran. A couple of boys are grappling with each other, straight over their shoulder and slammed onto the ground. But charities like this one not only offer the boys one meal a day, but activities like this, judo, music classes, as well as maths and science.
I'm Sarah Mohammadi. Here are some students, some children. Every day they come here, they eat their lunch. Here is a place for children that cannot have good food every day. And here we are sure that they can eat one lunch.
One decent meal a day.
Yes.
The prices of basic food items, vegetables and meat, have more than doubled in the past year. Zofre Farzaneh told me that her family had been plunged into poverty, and she blames Donald Trump.
I'm not sure what he gains from this, hurting us. He shouldn't be doing this. Thank God we have a piece of bread and cheese to eat. At least we have peace in Iran. There's no war. I thank God that I'm an Iranian.
The American sanctions on Iran have affected all aspects of this country's economy. And we're at a car mechanics. And one of the men working here, Daoud Nasiri, tells me that his salary has halved since the sanctions were imposed. And the reason for that is a loss of business.
We start working on the cars and then they get stuck here. We often have to wait 20 days for the spare parts. I have to work all day just to get by. I can't afford to take any time off. If they lift the sanctions, the dollar exchange rate will improve and we will be able to get spare parts again. And that means more customers and my quality of life will improve.
Some Iranians say official corruption is also damaging the economy. But at this printing plant, there's no mention of that in the newspapers coming off the presses. Instead, the tightly controlled media here blames the man on all the front pages, the American president. And one of the workers, Masoud Rezaei, has this message for him.
Your cruel sanctions are affecting the poor, who are already under pressure. These are the people who are getting crushed. Those in power won't suffer at all. People can't pay their rents. They can't buy a car. We're all under pressure. We're not after war. What does he want to prove bringing his warships to the Middle East? Is he looking for war? Let's assume there's a war. Many will get killed. Both sides will lose.
Iran's leaders have called the sanctions economic warfare. This country feels cornered by America, abandoned by Europe. Iran says it is willing to negotiate with America if Washington lifts the sanctions. But for the moment, neither side is backing down.
A new rule that comes into force in the United States today is expected to prevent hundreds of thousands of migrants from claiming asylum there. The UN Refugee Agency says the measure could breach international law. Imogen Folks reports.
The UN Refugee Agency says the new US policy is severe and will put vulnerable families at risk. Denying asylum to those who arrive on America's southern borders if they have passed through another country first flies in the face, the UN believes, of international law Washington has long signed up to. Many of those arriving in the US are fleeing persecution and brutal violence, the refugee agency says, and will have been offered no protection in transit countries.
Events are taking place around the world today to mark 50 years since NASA sent the Apollo 11 mission to the moon. The commemorations, including a live broadcast reuniting the astronauts Buzz Aldrin and Michael Collins, are focusing on the Kennedy Space Center in Florida, where the rocket blasted off on July the 16th, 1969. The last manned mission to the moon was in 1972, but that could soon be about to change. Our science editor Tom Fielden has more.
And God willing, as we shall return.
Gene Cernan, the last man to set foot on the surface of the moon, bids an emotional farewell on the lunar surface as the crew of Apollo 17 prepare to return to Earth. At the time, and even though the Apollo era was at an end, it was widely assumed we would soon be back.
Rather than lead in space, too often we've chosen to drift.
But that was 47 years ago.
When we drift, we fall behind.
50 years, Vice President Mike Pence reminded members of the National Space Council in March, since that first small step.
In the debate that followed, sending Americans to the moon was treated as a triumph to be remembered, but not repeated.
But now, really for the first time since the Apollo era came to an end, there's a comprehensive plan to go back to the moon and beyond.
We will return American astronauts to the moon, not only to leave behind footprints and flags, but to build the foundation we need to send Americans to Mars and beyond.
That plan is Artemis, aptly named after the twin sister of Apollo and goddess of the moon, and it is much more than a footprints and flags dash. NASA's Stuart McClung.
I like to think of it as an enabler, right? We'll get back to the moon. We will set the stage for even further exploration. And so it's not just get out there. It's get out and use and prove and then build off of that.
And building in space is a key element in the Artemis program. Jennifer Lopez is a former technology lead on the International Space Station and founder of NASA's Datanaut Corp.
The first 3D printer was launched to the space station about 4 or 5 years ago. So starting with that as the baseline and now looking at using a regolith, which is the material on the surface of the moon, and integrating that into these new structures. The long-term goals are to essentially build full habitats or large structures in space.
So if I'm now in control of the robot...
Aiding and abetting humanity as we build our way out into the solar system will be a fleet of robotic and semi-autonomous landers, rovers and scientific instruments and devices.
So it would do exactly the same thing.
At the European Space Agency's Human Robotic Interaction Laboratory near Amsterdam, Thomas Kruger's designing a wearable exoskeleton that could one day control a robotic explorer on the surface of a distant world.
In our scenario, the astronauts orbit the planet, we send the robots down, and the robot would mimic my movement. You see,
so you swing your arm forwards and backwards, you lift up and down, you reach out to pick something up.
Indeed.
And on the planet below, the robot is going to do the same thing.
Yes, it does the same thing.
And because this is no longer a bipolar geopolitical race, ESA's James Carpenter believes it will be a global effort for all mankind.
There are countries investing, agencies investing, the private sector investing, new rationales emerging. And so right now is really a critical point. It's the point where we as a species become a spacefaring species. It is starting and it's happening now.
Dr. Mary Ellen Weber flew twice on NASA's shuttle missions. When Apollo 11 took off, she was a six-year-old girl. She spoke to Ben James from her home in California.
I remember very vividly the entire Apollo program, and certainly when Neil Armstrong first stepped foot on the moon. I was with my family at my grandmother's home staring at a tiny TV, you know, black and white, and just riveted. And I remember, you know, they stepped foot down on the moon. And I remember my mother saying, oh, okay, now hurry up. You're there. Now get back home. Get home safe. And so I think everybody appreciated the not only how exciting it was, but just how dangerous and crazy it was what was happening.
It must have been such an event as families gathered to watch it. Do you remember anyone saying anything about, well, you could potentially be up there one day?
Oh, absolutely not. You have to remember that it was ludicrous to think of a girl or a woman ever going into space. That was not something we did. Girls considered being nurses and teachers, and that was about it. You know, and it's funny you say that. I remember listening to one of my colleagues talk about a very similar experience, watching them land and step foot on the moon for the first time. And he got a space helmet toy for Christmas, and he put it on. He said, I never took it off for 2 weeks, and I knew I wanted to be an astronaut. And I remember watching, and I remember very vividly, for Christmas, I got a set of cardboard kitchen appliances that I could set up in my bedroom so that I could play house. And so it was a very different time for me. So while I was riveted, the idea of being an astronaut, I mean, it was just not even something anyone considered, much less me.
But when you look back, did it unlock something in you that did eventually lead you to your career? Or is it more complicated than that? Is that just a lovely, simplistic path that we imagine might have been the case?
Well, I do think it's somewhat of a simple path that you described. The reason why I tell that story is because we have come so very far. Now, women and girls, women can do anything and girls can dream of anything. And they're spoken to in a very different way. And so I tell the story, not that it didn't inspire me, but just to exemplify that we are in a different world. 50 years may seem like a long time, but it is a blink of an eye, and we have just come so far.
Mary Ellen Weber, and at bbcworldservice.com, you'll find more programmes marking the 50th anniversary of the Apollo 11 landing. Three of the world's greatest spaceflight engineers discuss the future of space travel in the Engineers Debate, and witness history, his first-hand accounts of space exploration. Listen at bbcworldservice.com/13minutes, and it's the number 13 in that address. Now, back on planet Earth, it's not been a great few days for New Zealand. After an agonising defeat in Sunday's Cricket World Cup final, they've only gone and lost another title to the British. They can no longer claim the world's steepest street. Previously, in Dunedin, it's now officially in Wales, as Jonathan Savage reports.
It's on the rugby pitch that Wales and New Zealand are familiar rivals, but this is a street fight. Or rather, a battle between two streets. Baldwin Street in Dunedin, whose 35% gradient has been officially surpassed by Forth Penfleth in Harlech, North Wales. The Welsh have fought for a year to take the title in the Guinness Book of Records, and now they finally prove that their own road has a gradient of 37.45%. Sarah Badden coordinated the claim.
Oh, we're absolutely elated and exhausted, of course, after the hard work over the last year. You know, I can remember as a little girl walking up this road every Sunday to Sunday school. A little lady from our street called Blod used to bring us up, and she did the same for many generations. It's very much part of our culture here.
Forth Penfleth had to meet certain criteria. A public thoroughfare, at least 10 metres long, with buildings on both sides. In New Zealand, disappointment. Journalist Hamish McNeely has been writing profitably about Baldwin Street for over a decade.
Well, I'm still angry. I'm angry over lots of things in the world this week, but this has really just ruined my week.
But Hamish has a warning for the Welsh. Be careful what you wish for.
Every year it's just become more and more popular, particularly with Dunedin being a harbour city, so we have cruise ships coming in, and it's just a constant stream of tourists going there. So I talked to a lady today who often has tourists wandering around her house, taking photographs inside, all around her garden. People think it's like some sort of Disneyland attraction.
For Kiwis, there is still plenty to celebrate in what I think we can now call their bitter rivalry with the Welsh. A dominant record in rugby, a superior number of sheep, and the longest place name in the world. Yes, while Welsh tongues can rattle off. New Zealand goes further. With apologies, can I have a one-way ticket, please, to Tō Mata Whatangi Hanga Kōoa Tamatia Turi Pokauka Puki Maunga Horonuku Paukai Whenua Kitani Tau? What? You want me to spell it?
Proof there ain't no word long enough for Jonathan Savage there. And that's all from us for now, but there will be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Mark Lobel. Until next time, goodbye.